The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
Look at it, it's so cute.
The terrible Australian, B. Jemine.
As Nicolas Cage, I should have played Tom Sawyer in this movie. But then they asked me and I was like, that's too typical of a role. I actually want to play the role of the submarine.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
That was a at the time.
Mature themes.
I mean, if the octopus in Aquaman can do it, so can Adam Sandler.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka D. Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 159 of the Super Podcast. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello, hello. What a lovely introduction, as always. Thank you, Bede. How are you doing?
I try to give you the best. Oh, not too bad, thanks. I always try to give you the best introductions, Marcy, because I know if I get it wrong, you'll get angry at me, and then I'm banned from the podcast again.
That's true.
Unless I do puns about specific things, and then you're like, you know what, you're banned for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I get even more angry when we do that, but yes. But thank you for a lovely intro. Better than the intros I give you, because I call you terrible, but that's another story. You're not exactly. Really terrible. Everybody loves Bede, unironically.
I think after watching that that so-called documentary a few weeks ago, Marty, I just know I'm probably like the least terrible Australian out of everyone.
Yeah. Was shameful, but anyway.
Marcy, we're not alone on this episode.
No, we have two very special guests. I'm very excited.
Indeed.
One has been on our podcast, one hasn't. So it's like, ooh, party time.
Indeed, Marcy, because that means this other person's about to get their cherry popped on the show. So, and of course, and there are two guests for tonight. They are the hosts of the Indicator podcast, and that is Tony and John. Hello, Tony and John. How are you guys?
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening. Doing well, thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Indeed. Well, Tony, this is your first time on the show, but John, this is your second time having you previously on the episode where we did an audio commentary on the film Airheads.
Yes.
So it's nice that you're back, and also Tony for being on the first time as well.
Yes, I'm really excited for it. Thank you so much. And gotta say, my cherry popping feels sensational. So thank you.
Bede always does it very gently, just with a pop.
Indeed. I just go pop.
And it's done.
Get it over with.
Exactly.
It does. Yes.
Exactly. But moving away from cherry popping, because we could easily talk about that for hours, but we have a more important topic. To talk about. Although, this one topic in particular has a different type of popping, and usually it's either on the eyeballs or brains or something else. And that, of course, is one of our favorite topics we like to talk about on this show, which, of course, is horror.
Ooh.
And for this episode of the show, the four of us are going to be talking about our top three horror hidden gems of the 2000s.
Yes, I believe this was your idea to sort of look at the more, I guess, not as well-known horror of the 2000s. So it's a very interesting and intriguing subject, Bede.
Indeed. Like, I think for me, because, you know, I'm sort of, like, you know, the late 90s were kind of my introduction to horror, but it was really the 2000s that kind of cemented it for me, because there was a lot of great films that came out, even though there were some pretty different types of trends of their various kind of topics that happened during the 2000s, because this was the decade where we had, like, a ton of remakes happened, and also the quote-unquote torture porn genre also happened, or also adaptations of sort of Asian horror cinema were being adapted for the English language audiences. So there was definitely quite a lot of different types of horror films that came out through the decade. But even though there were some pretty big major players, there are some pretty awesome undiscovered gems that aren't really as talked about as many as.
Yeah, I think more so maybe the titles are a little bit more maybe well-known specifically in the horror community, but we just want to talk about some pretty cool films that maybe don't get mentioned as much when you talk about 2000s horror, and maybe people should.
Indeed, indeed.
And we know our guests love horror, so we had to bring them on. Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off.
But I was going to say, Tony and John, maybe you first, Tony, then John. What are your overall thoughts on the 2000s as a whole for the horror genre?
2000s as a whole, I got to say, as it was mainly Asian cinema remakes like The Ring, The Grudge, and a few others. It's just, and also there were some really good original horror titles. Like one of my favorites, which I haven't chosen from one of my top three, is there's so many to choose from. 2000s horror, like one of my favorite 2000 horror films is Drag Me to Hell. Sam Raimi's return to horror. And I thought that was sensational.
Yeah.
And also Stephen King. There was this good Stephen King one in The Mist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was another good one from 2007. Mm. And there was just so many good ones. But I don't want to mention the top three, which I'm going to be discussing later on.
Yeah.
But, it was mainly just a good year for Asian remakes and some original horror as well. But all in all, the 2000s was a good year. A good decade.
Yeah.
We sort of had the pickup because in the 90s we had more like direct-to-video, and then as video phased out, we got sort of more video on demand and then DVD, and we saw a lot of rise in the like direct-to-DVD, VOD in the 2000s, and some, you know, were great, some were not so great, but it was still, it wasn't necessarily, you know, that cinematic experience. It was a very sort of home experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and John, what about you?
Yeah, look, I have a lot of fondness towards the 2000s because that was when I was really becoming a massive horror fanatic, particularly the early 2000s. There's a lot of good stuff there, like you mentioned, Tony, some, and growing up, stuff like Ginger Snaps and these really awesome, I won't mention them because they're pretty well known, but these really awesome sort of horror movies were coming to fruition. And growing up, it was a great time, the 2000s. Like I said, movies had... I say this a lot, but 2000s horror movies had budgets. They're real movies. They were shot on film still, 35 mil. Like, and direct-to-video movies had a couple of million-dollar budgets. Like now, direct-to-streaming, you see the stuff on Amazon Prime shot on some iPhone for $5,000.
How many Amityville films have come out just this week alone? Because I always have seen three.
I think there's about 50 that just came out to it yesterday.
Exactly.
See, Marcy, I think maybe we should do a podcast on all these Amityville straight-to-DVD movies and then do them for the show.
Yeah, there's at least half are on Tubi.
Yes.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
John, it wouldn't surprise me if you have every single one of them physical copy.
Amityville in the hood.
Well, even like I said, stuff like Leprechaun in the Hood, like these were like, once again, like $2-3 million movies. Like there was a line of quality in the 2000s, which we are severely lacking now in horror. But anyway, that's just me, shouting in the cloud, being an angry old guy. But no, like I said, there's a lot of remakes. But yeah, it was a good decade. I look at it fondly, I saw a lot of stuff in the cinemas around that time.
For me, it was a lot of DVD stuff and discoveries of things like seeing Saw as a new release DVD hire, things like that, and then getting torn to shreds when I saw The Descent after all the hype around it, and I was just like meh. A lot of hype because we sort of like the whole internet community was really growing then, and that kind of overhyped me for so much, and it's been that I have to revisit things later to appreciate them more. But sorry, Bede. I cut you off again.
I was also going to say that the 2000s were also when kind of 70s-esque horror sort of made a comeback as well.
Like the Rob Zombie type.
Yes.
Yeah, or Hostel or Wolf Creek. And then, of course, you kind of see that cycle because the early to mid-2000s were 80s-esque horror, and now we're seeing... 90s. Kind of horror shift to more kind of 90s feel as well, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, and then the next decade we'll get 2000s horror feel because, We got to keep up with the, you know, 20 years in the past, which I don't want to think about it. We're getting old. I'm going to be 80 next week. It's ridiculous.
But we'll get right to it. Since we've all got our lists together, we have our top threes. And Marcy, would you like to tell us what is your first pick as your what are a hidden gem from the 2000s?
Yeah. So as we normally do with our lists, we'll go one by one and we'll talk about one movie each till we've all done our three after several loops. I'm going to go with something from the year 2000 and from our country of origin of Australia. And that is the movie Cut, which was Australia's answer to Scream. Now, Cut is not the best movie ever made. It has its flaws, but for me, like, I saw this when it came out. I was very much, you know, that Scream hype train lasted for years, and you wanted to see slashes and horrors and da-da-da-da, and, you know, it was an Aussie one, and, oh, Molly Ringwald. They got Molly Ringwald in it. There's Kylie Minogue cameo. It's like, yeah, hell yeah, let's do this. And when I watched it, I'm like, this is so bizarre. This is so different. It's doing all these weird things that you don't really see in, like, the slashes, and I just have such a fondness for Cut. Like, yeah, the reputation is it's kind of crap, but it's, for me, it's the good kind of crap. I don't necessarily think it's crap. They tried, and they delivered something that, for me, is really entertaining, and at the end of the day, that's what really matters. I want to be entertained. I want to enjoy it on some level, and that's what Cut does, and I think it is one of our more underrated horror entries into, you know, that kind of transition from the 90s to the 2000s, and I will defend Cut till the day I die, I'm just saying. And Bede, you and I actually rewatched this a few years ago, and we had a blast. Absolute blast definitely. With it. And my co-host on the King Zones Book Club podcast, Steve, I recommended some Australian horror, and I said, you know what, I think you might dig Cut. And he got back to me, I think the next day or whenever, and he said, yeah, it's got its flaws, but it was a lot of fun. He really enjoyed the vibe and everything. And I'm like, it holds up. Like, it's goofy, awesome fun. But what do you guys think about Cut? I'm assuming you've seen it. Whoever wants to talk, chime in.
I'll let Tony and John go first because I have quite a history with this film.
Yes. Are you fans? Yep.
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 Yeah, yeah. I saw it many years ago. It's funny enough, I did get the Blu-ray, but I still haven't rewatched it. It's been a long time, but I do remember liking it a bit, and I need to go back and watch it. But yes.
And Tony. And
what about you, Tony?
Well, I did like it. I just got the Blu-ray recently myself.
Oh, awesome.
You did. But I first saw it as a preview cassette where I used to work at Blockbuster Video.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Watched it on VHS, and I thought, damn, this was terrible. But then when I watched it again, I thought, this is fun. This is great.
Yeah. Really
great slasher film. But it's good that, like you see Molly Ringwald. Who would have thought you would see Molly Ringwald in an Aussie slasher? And Kylie Minogue, of course. And it's a fun film. Absolutely. Definitely. But back in the day, I believe it didn't do so well at the box office.
Oh, no.
No, it sort of ended up getting that reputation of this is shit.
Yeah.
And it just, it really, like, for me, it's just fun. Like, I thought it was fun back then. I thought, yeah, it's average, but it's fun. And I like that, you know, the killer is not, like, a physical thing. And that's the kind of twist that I was like, you know what? I like this. I like that it's being more adventurous, that it's not just a no-name, whoever the fuck it is, can't be killed. You know, superhuman, you know, type of character, like it, you know, like a Freddy Krueger type thing. It does something different where, you know, not as iconic, but Bede, you definitely have things to say on Cut. I know you are very fond of this film, but before I send it over to you, I will say Cut and Houseboat Horror make for a fucking wicked double feature.
They're practically the same film. And I should know this because I went to a double feature screening of both of them at Monster Fest a few years back.
Perfect.
So that was
double.
A lot of fun. But I'm going to say, Marty, and maybe it's just me tooting my own horn as per usual, but if I would have to say if someone was the biggest super fan of Cut, it's probably me.
Yes, it is.
I have been obsessed with this film ever since it came out. Because I first heard about it. Because, I mean, even though it didn't do that well at the box office, I do remember it was marketed, like, everywhere. Like, it was, like, the posters were everywhere. Yeah. The soundtrack was around. And, like, I think it was, like, because I was just only started getting into horror film at the time. And I was being particularly drawn to slashers since that was kind of the first genre that made me very interested in horror. So when I sort of found out, oh, there's an Australian slasher film coming, I was just, like, hugely excited to see it. And I didn't see it at the cinema because, like, I was living in a country town at the time, so I wasn't anywhere near one.
You get nothing.
But once the movie... yeah, exactly. And once that movie came out on VHS, I rented that a lot to... And I eventually ended up buying a VHS copy of it. And after that, I also bought it on DVD. I also bought the Blu-ray as well. I even had the soundtrack somewhere in storage, so Jesus. I had to have that. And, like, I even, of course, and finally full circle, I got to see it on the big screen at Monster Fest. I even got to ask Kimball Rendell a question about the film. And I was kind of... So it's been a little while since I remember. I think I asked him because I was sort of curious because, like, the killer in the film is kind of like a mishmash of basically Freddy, Michael, and Jason. I kind of asked him, what was the process of making this killer and what led to the final version of the film? And I think from what I remember from the interview, and I'm paraphrasing, so since it has been a few years, pretty much he just said, like, originally the killer was never meant to be a supernatural killer. And it was really just like as the killer changed so much as the script was being written, and then they kind of just ended up being in this version. And even the design was very different from the first initial, like, design of Scarman. And yeah, and I've just sort of been fascinated by this film. Yeah, I mean, it is definitely not a quality film, and it pretty much was made to capitalize on Scream, because, like, every slasher film everywhere all over the world was at the time. But I think what makes this one different is it does have that sort of, like, it is a product of the 90s, but it does have that sort of 80s vibe to it as well. And it also has a good sense of humor about itself as well. It doesn't take itself seriously at all. And it's not afraid to get a little crazy and insane, particularly in the last half of that film, where pretty much all logic goes out the window and it just becomes complete insanity.
Very true. But yes, highly recommended.
Yes. And Tony, tell us your first film from your list.
My first film is a remake. And it's a remake from the original 1971 film. It is called Willard.
Yes.
Ooh.
And starring Crispin Glover, Ali Ermey, and Laura Eleanor Herring from Mulholland Drive. And I gotta say, oh boy, I saw this at the the Chevelle Cinema, in Sydney, And then it was released around a couple of weeks after Crispin Glover himself was here in Sydney promoting his movies. And I watched it and I just thought, damn, that's one creepy film. And if you have a fear of rats, do not watch this film, whatever you do. But Crispin Glover was perfectly cast with this film, absolutely. Like, the original character of Willard in 1971 was played by the legendary Bruce Davison. That was a great film too, and that also had a sequel for called Ben. That was made in 1972 as well. And of course, we all know the theme song for that one from Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Yeah. which they funnily enough re-record again for this one with Crispin Glover.
Crispin Glover recorded the song of Ben for this one, and my goodness, that movie stuck with me. I loved it. I've always loved this one.
I'm with you on that.
Definitely.
It stuck with me too, and I did watch it quite a few times when it came out, rented the DVD and everything. I thought it was just such a good, unexpected, kind of really solid remake with really good, you know, great, it casted perfectly, and the rats, again, just, you feel them as characters. It's wonderful. Like, Willard would have been on my list if... I kind of narrowed mine down, but it was one of the ones I thought of. So I'm glad you picked it, because I do really appreciate and adore this version too.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a great pick. What about you guys? What are your feelings, John?
You go first, John.
Johnny.
Yeah, I love Willard. I remember seeing it when it first. I didn't see it. I saw it on DVD as a new rental, and I love it too. I think he's perfectly cast. Glover. The army of rats I really loved even his boss. Was it Ali?
Yeah, Ali Omi.
His boss, and he's just perfectly cast. So everyone's just perfect in that film, and it's really well done, I've always liked that film. So very, very good choice, and highly too.
Yeah, if people haven't seen it, double bill it with the original. It's great stuff, honestly.
I'll do a triple with Ben.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of you. I think it is a really strong remake. I think I saw this one before, many years before I actually saw the original. So I didn't know what to expect, but after hearing about it, I was very excited to check it out, particularly because, like, I sort of do remember Crispin Glover, but I wasn't aware that he was in the Back to the Future films, but I remember that my first exposure to him was in in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Mm-hmm. So that was my
his
first
brilliant
exposure to him.
Dance moves that we recreated 1 year. I remember that.
Exactly. And I sort of thought he was like perfectly cast here. And I know he wasn't the first choice because I think Joaquin Phoenix and Macaulay Culkin were in talks to play the character. Yes. And I think they would have. I think they would have been pretty interesting choices, but I think this is one of those roles that Crispin Glover, who kind of for most of his roles has been, you know, as a character actor or a supporting character, getting a chance to finally shine in a lead role in a rare one. And I thought he just did a phenomenal job, and, you know, it's really well made. And it's kind of a shame, like, Glenn Morgan, who wrote and directed the film, like, he would do the Black Christmas remake that came out 3 years later. And then after that, he never directed another film again, which is a shame. Because I think he does actually have a lot of talent, especially even though, the Black Christmas remake wasn't good. It does have style and some pretty interesting elements to it. But I think just seeing this film in particular, you just know, like, this is a very talented filmmaker.
Yeah, that Black Christmas 2006 looks like Citizen Kane compared to the one that came out a couple of years ago, that Black Christmas remake.
I haven't seen that one, but I didn't like the 2000s one really at all.
2001 is not that bad in comparison.
Yeah, like if I think about it, I'm like, you know what, it's not that terrible, but it kind of is terrible. But again, maybe I'll revisit that someday. But yeah, now I really want to rewatch Willard. It's been a few years. I'm so glad you picked that, Tony. It's such a great movie.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it is a good film. Definitely.
Beautiful.
What about you, Joel? What is your first pick?
Yes, my first pick is from 2001. It's Dagon, which is a Stuart Gordon film, which until the recent, I mean, it did get a recent Blu-ray release, so it has got a little bit of exposure. But before that, it was pretty damn obscure, and I remember hiring this as a new release DVD. I think it was like a Madman DVD or something, just being blown away by it. I think it was one of the best Lovecraft films I'd ever seen at the time, because I just think it's a really underrated film. So essentially, this couple ends up on this island, and they're pretty much stranded there. And there's something mysterious going on there, and you don't know what it is. Like, you know, are they creatures? Are they humans? And it's very interesting. If you ever played or seen Resident Evil 4, which came out, it came out a couple of years later, they pretty much rip off Dagon, because Dagon set in this European village, and essentially, you know, there are these creatures, and you don't know what's going on. It's a bit of a mystery, and he's trying to navigate his way around. But yeah, anyway, like I said, Dagon, I just think it's a really great film. Some incredible special effects, really pays tribute to the Lovecraft lore. And Stuart Gordon, just, you know, at his peak of directing, because obviously he'd kind of been on his way out at this point. But yeah, I just think it's a really good, underrated and creepy and well-made little film. a little sci-fi gem. But yeah, has anyone seen Dagon?
Yeah, Bede and I were actually talking about that film the other day, and I can't remember why it came up in conversation, to be honest.
But I think we were talking about Fear Itself. That's probably why.
Yeah, mate, it could have been. And because I did see Dagon, like you did, John, when it first came out, because at that point, I was massively into like Reanimator. So still my favorite horror movie of all time. Discovering Stuart Gordon and, you know, discovering more about like Lovecraft and I didn't really like it that much when I first saw it. And then I realized it's not an actual adaptation of the story Dagon. It is a more of an adaptation of The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And actually having that knowledge and then having read both those short stories, one of my Lovecraft collections, I actually appreciated it a lot more. And on subsequent rewatches, I really appreciate it a lot more. And it's quite a solid film. And it's, Stuart Gordon, for me, I think he's one of the more fascinating, interesting directors where he tackles so much stuff, but always going back to the Lovecraft. And he kind of gets it in a more modern way, which is what I appreciate. Yeah. But I would say it's definitely worth checking out for those who haven't. It's a pretty solid one.
Well, I guess for me, having watched it for the first time a couple of years ago, I was kind of more mixed on it than anything else. Like, I really enjoyed a lot of Stuart Gordon's films up to that point. But I don't know, something about it just didn't quite hit with me with this one. I think because it was sort of how it approached the story was a little bit of a mixed bag. But there were still a lot of interesting elements to it. And I think it is still a pretty interesting film, even though I do think it was flawed. But at least there's a lot of interesting stuff in it that sort of make it a memorable experience when you watch it.
And Tony...
Yes, I saw Dagon late. I actually saw it for the first time just a few years ago, and boy, did I regret it, missing not watching it earlier. It's definitely one of, I really liked it. I think it's one of Stuart Gordon's best films, and visually, I loved it. It was a spectacle. Yeah, of course, with the H.P. Lovecraft, now with H.P. Lovecraft getting more and more of a revival now, it was good. I just thought it was visually stunning, and I absolutely adored it. And
It's got a good visual aesthetic that really kind of suits the story.
Yeah, very visual, very gothic and heavy, gothic style. It's
gothic seaside type.
Seaside, and I love those. And that's what I like about it. But no spoilers. But there are a lot of fish people in it, and some pretty. Yeah. Pretty cool practical effects as well. Spanish squid people, but yeah.
Yeah, really cool pick. I appreciate that. I think, Bede, it's your turn.
Alrighty, I guess for my first pick, I'm pretty much going to be doing mine in order of when they released. So this one in particular I'm going to talk about first is from 2000. And I think what makes this one will probably stand out from the other films we're going to be talking about from our list is that this one has quite a bit of a pedigree behind it because it received 2 Oscar nominations when it came out, despite still being a very underrated film. And my first pick is Shadow of the Vampire.
Love that movie so much. Oh, my God. Love it. Yes,
for those out there who don't know Shadow of the Vampire, it's pretty much is about the making of the legendary silent film Nosferatu. And... however, though, because like everyone knows that the actor who plays the vampire in it, Count Orlok, who's played by Max Schreck, like everyone sort of knows that he's just an actor playing a vampire. But at the time of that film's release, and even for quite a little while afterwards, there was always rumors that people thought that Max Schreck really was a vampire because he was just so creepy and menacing in the film, and people honestly legit thought that. What he looked like, and that he was like a for real vampire. So basically, this movie is kind of not really, even though, it's based on a true story, it's more about sort of making a film version of that rumor. Like, what would happen if director F.W. Moreau, played by John Malkovich in this film, is about to make the film Nosferatu, and then he happens to stumble across an actual vampire and cast him in the film.
It's kind of like a what if, you know, it's like a historical what if kind of scenario, which makes it fascinating. Sorry.
Indeed, and also Max Schreck in this film is played by Willem Dafoe, who is absolutely astonishing in the film.
Everyone's so good.
And also like the makeup they do on him makes him look so much like Count Rolock in the film. And of course, you know, Willem Dafoe got an Oscar nomination for his role, and the makeup also got nominated too. But this is a film that is got a lot of atmosphere. It does a really good job like recreating a lot of the famous shots from Nosferatu. And you got like a huge supporting cast, because this film also has like Cary Elwes, Ed Izzard, Udo Kier, Catherine McCormack. And also the film is like also surprisingly funny as well, while also being genuinely creepy, particularly in the last half of the film. And of course, what makes this film also pretty awesome is that it was produced by Nicolas Cage.
Well, that, you know, that just sells anything.
Exactly.
It's why didn't he play all the characters? What a wasted opportunity.
Exactly. He could have played Count Orlok. He could have played F.W. Moreau. There's still time. Mm-hmm. Or maybe like they could do another version where he plays Count Orlok, but Werner Herzog plays F.W. Moreau.
Done. I'm there.
But then it's actually really a movie about the making of the 70s Nosferatu film with Klaus Kinski and Werner Herzog.
Down. Done.
Yes.
No,
so we're inceptioning this.
I'm so glad, you know, someone picked this, because it's a beautiful, brilliant film. Again, something I saw when it came out, and I was just so mesmerized by it that it was just such a unique, different movie. Again, if you haven't seen it, what are you doing with your life? Watch it.
Like, I know it's not as readily available now as it
was. No excuse.
Ago. Yeah, I think this is a movie that needs to be re-released on Blu-ray.
Where's my 4K of Shadow of Vampire?
Exactly. And also, you know, kind of be rediscovered by audiences. But, John and Tony, what do you guys think of this movie, if you've seen it?
Oh, I've seen it, all right. I actually saw it on opening weekend at the cinema.
Oh.
I loved it. And, oh God, Willem Dafoe was just phenomenal. He should have won an Academy Award for it, but nomination was good enough. But,
yes.
But, oh boy, my goodness, that performance of his own. I'll never forget, there was one sequence in the middle of the film that Murnau and Schreck had an argument, and all of a sudden, Schreck gives this menacing look towards Malkovich's, to Murnau's face. He just has that scary smile, and Murnau just goes back in fear. And I just thought, oh boy, I'll never forget for as long as I live. That performance was phenomenal, and the movie itself was just wonderful. Especially if you're a cinephile and you love silent cinema.
Oh yeah,
you'll love this one, absolutely. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I love Shadow of the Vampire. It's another film, didn't see in the cinemas, but one of those, once again, these are all new rental DVDs at the time, so I remember seeing it, and yeah, it just captures the time perfectly. And I also love silent cinema, so I think it's brilliant. And once again, Malkovich is just, you know, killing it in the role. You're right, it has got humor and it has this really good balance. And I just want to say, like, I think the director's really underrated, because he because I knew of him before, because he did that, he did this
Forgotten,
which is another sort of legendary urban legend type film, which is just visually unbelievable. Like, there hasn't been a film look, you know, quite close to ever. And the guy went off and did some crime film, Suspect Zero, which I saw as well, but and then he just kind of fade off the map, which is really sad, because I think he's got such talent. But Shadow of the Vampire is it needs a rediscovery. Maybe I would say it's even, like, you know, Criterion worthy. It needs a proper 4K restoration. Because I've got an old Mad Men DVD, which, you know, kind of is okay, but, you know, watching it now, it just doesn't do justice. But yes, very good pick. I love this film.
Very good, Pete. Very good. You did well.
Why, thank you. But Marcy, what is your number two pick?
Yeah, I think like you, I'm sort of going in, I guess, release order. So I've picked one that I discovered a few years ago for my 31 Days of Horror. And this was before we hit pandemic and lockdown and loneliness and isolation and all sorts. And that is one of the Japanese films that has since got a American crappy remake that I refuse to watch, Pulse from 2001. And this is a film that kind of is such an interesting examination on depression, grief, loneliness, isolation. It's insane that, and it sort of captures this early internet type of, I'm trying to think of the right word, like those earlier days where it's sort of kind of still a bit unknown, and you know, the internet could do all sorts of weird things, and there's like the ghosts and things like that. And I don't want to give too much away with Pulse, but I wasn't sure like what to expect. But that's the thing with a lot of these like Japanese horror, especially from this era, they're not just there for, you know, some jump scares and a bit of gore. There's these themes and ideas that cut so deep, and it's why they leave this, you know, lasting impression. And the film is sort of, I guess, the synopsis that kind of went around was, it's like, you know, there could be spirits trying to get through the human world, through the internet, but it's so much more than that. When you look at it through sort of after being through a pandemic, it hits on a completely different level. And it ends up being like a very depressing, but such a hard hitting film. And it's so sad. It has a sadness, but there's such truth to it. And it is a very unique horror film. And I'm not going to watch any shitty remake. It's great the way it is. And I think it is one of the more ones that doesn't get mentioned as much when it comes to this kind of general era of J horror, where it doesn't really get mentioned as much as, say, The Ring or The Grudge. But yeah, I'd be curious to hear what you guys think if you've seen Pulse. Tony, have you seen it?
Pulse. Yes, I have seen Pulse, but I'm like you, Marcy. I saw it a little bit later as well. And I gotta say, I agree with you totally with the especially watching it now with this pandemic and lockdown. Well, it does give it gives it a different experience, that's for sure. But yes, it's a very, as you said, it is a very bleak movie, very depressing, but phenomenal. The Japanese certainly know how to make fantastic horror films. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love Japanese cinema so much. And yeah, it feels sort of even more personal because, you know, during the last 2 years, and especially I think for the four of us, is we've connected really strongly as friends through, you know, online, because we can't go out and see people. And and that's what this, you get that from this film, like there's this need to have some kind of human interaction. And we were so closed off from all of that, that we were reaching out on the internet to our friends. So
yeah.
That's Jono. What about you, mate?
Hi, Pulse. Yeah, I love Pulse. That is one that I got, I can't remember when, maybe a couple of years after, I picked up the local Eastern Eye DVD here, and I was just blown away by it. And once again, it didn't impact me at the time as much, but now that I've gone back and it got a Blu-ray a couple of years ago, I reevaluated it, and it's so far ahead of its time. Like, you're right, like, to the point where, I mean, this is pre-social media, but it's quite interesting because it is telling about people in loneliness and isolation and depression, and there's some haunting stuff, like I said, like when they go outside and it's a ghost town, where is everyone, which is, once again, very pandemic-like. I just remember being freaked out. This, I won't spoil a certain scene with a certain woman kind of crawling.
Yeah.
Which just, like, what the hell? So it's got those typical, I guess, like, tick the boxes sort of J horror, but the thing about Kurosawa, not Akira Kurosawa, this Kurosawa, yes, he has a lot of interesting commentary in his horror films, and his other film he did was Cure, and Cure is probably my favorite Japanese horror film of all time. It's a masterpiece of detective horror thriller suspense. But he, once again, he manages to get interesting themes mixed in. So, yeah, I think Pulse is, please, you know, everyone check it out. And I think, like I said, it's so relevant today with this disconnected world we're living in, especially when you're talking about stuff like the metaverse and stuff. The disconnection's getting even worse. And this film does touch on that pretty nicely.
As you said, it was very ahead of its time, but I feel like Japan, especially with their technology, have always been more ahead of us in, you know, everywhere else. And you can definitely feel, you know, where it's coming from. But Beat, I can't remember. Did you recommend this one to me?
I did.
There you go.
Because it was one of my 31 Days of Horror films about 5 years ago. So it was one of my picks. But I've been hearing about this film for many years, and I believe I did actually see the remake way before the original. And I think I even saw one of the direct-to-video sequels, I think. I'm not exactly sure. It's all a blur from what I remember of that time. but no, I really like this movie a lot. Like, it's definitely a very ambitious film. Like, it definitely is uneven in terms of its tone throughout, but I think what it gets across really well is what you've already said so far, is that it really captures that feeling of isolation and loneliness and grief. It does that really well while also just being this really creepy and unique ghost story. And it's interesting kind of looking back on that period of J-horror from the late 90s to early 2000s, where a lot of them sort of were interesting ghost stories that kind of mixed the supernatural with technology, which is something that at that point rarely a lot of films did, particularly in Western cinema. And of course, when the remake came out, that kind of opened up the floodgates for, I mean, a lot of these Asian horror films to be remade, but also bring a whole new audience to the originals. Because, you know, Asian horror is just so unique compared to any other horror anywhere else in the world. And Pulse is definitely probably one of the best examples of that, because, you know, even I mean, I haven't watched the movie since I first watched it, but I do think about it on occasion. And I think if I rewatched it now, given now that we've been in a pandemic for 2 years, I think it'll definitely hit differently, more so now than I did when I first watched it.
It's something that hits you on a completely different level, and it kind of reminds me, and it'll probably actually make a really interesting double feature to watch with, I'm trying to think of the bloody name of the movie, and I...
Fear.com.
No, it's not that. This was something that I watched. There we go. The Night Eats the World, French movie pre-pandemic, but again, it deals with very similar issues of what we've experienced in a pandemic, and I think that would make for a very fucking depressing and unsettling, like, oh my god, I need human contact double feature. But yeah, we'll move right along. I think Tony is next.
Tony, what is your next pick?
Okay, my next pick, that's from 2008, and it was a very obscure one. It came out straight to DVD here in Australia, but it would have been good to see it in cinemas. It is from director Ty West, and it is called The House of the Devil.
Yes.
I saw that on DVD, and from what I've heard of it, set in the 80s, shot in 16mm film, has Tom Noonan, Dee Wallace, and an unknown Greta Gerwig back then, but and Jocelyn Donahue, and my God, that that was one hell of a movie. I was intrigued with the premise of it, you know, about a babysitting job in the sinister Ullman house, and it just goes bonkers, and I just absolutely love it when movies go a bit crazy. And Ty West, he's a great young filmmaker back in 2008. He did a phenomenal job, and of course Tom Noonan, Dee Wallace, can't go wrong. And but Tom Noonan, he is perfect as playing creepy characters, especially as I was going to call it Red Dragon, but luckily I didn't. Manhunter.
Love Manhunter.
Yeah, and as Francis Dolarhyde, he was phenomenal in that. And also, but also one thing, another film that Tom Noonan did recently that he did every single voice was Charlie Kaufman's Anomalisa. That was a good one too. But yeah, but House of the Devil creeped me out, I have to say. But the atmosphere was phenomenal. And of course, giving it the 16mm shot film footage, it looked... It looks retro, and I just absolutely adored it. What did you think?
That had such a good authenticity. Mm. And I'd heard about it, and then when I finally saw it, I thought, this is really creepy. It's got great atmosphere, great performances, and then it goes batshit insane. I'm like, this is great. And this was another one I kind of had shortlisted for my list. So we're very much in sync with some of those picks. But yeah, no, mwah. And yeah, I think Ty West, with what I've seen of his work, I love it. Every film is very different and just gives us, as I said, different things, but this had this really good authenticity to the time period, and it's a really good kind of love letter to those kinds of creepy films. And yeah, definitely a recommendation for me. But I got to stop talking. Someone else talk.
John.
Jono, go.
I like House of the Devil. I like the soundtrack. I like the look of it. And once again, it was one of the first films of its time to do this 70s throwback. And it was, and once again, I think Noonan, like I said, is perfectly cast. It's one I haven't seen in a while. I need to go back and revisit. I actually remember I had to import it from the States. It was like a combo VHS DVD sort of pack. It was like a retro tapes of thing, but yeah, because it was pretty obscure. It just kind of went straight to DVD. But I like it quite a bit, and I think Ty West is a very underrated director. While the work,
I gotta agree with all of you. I do really like House of the Devil a lot. I wasn't sure what to expect when I first went into it, but I really loved what I saw. And I can definitely have the same way, because I know a lot of people sort of complain it's too slow, it takes a while to get going, and it doesn't really, I guess, quote-unquote, get interesting until, the legit last 15 minutes of the film. But for me, it really does capture the vibe of a 70s horror film really well. And I really like that Ty West went out of his way, not only to kind of shoot it in 16mm, but also go out of his way to kind of replicate the filmmaking style of that period. So that it feels authentic. It feels like this film was a lost film that came out from that period that was just released in 2008. And I think he does a really good job of it, because he does have a love of horror, because he's created so many great different varieties of films. But I think here with House of the Devil, it's definitely up there for me as one of his best. And it's just probably one of the strongest 70s throwback horror films that came out in the 2000s.
Yeah, it's got such a great sort of 70s, 80s vibe. And if you do watch a lot of these sort of similar-ish from the time, they were slow burn films. And it captured that great. But yeah, love it. Love that pick.
John, what is your second pick?
Yes, my second pick is a film which is right at the tail end of the decade, probably the end of the direct-to-video era. It is a direct-to-video film called The Hills Run Red. And this is a film which, got dumped to DVD over here. It was a moderately budget Warner Brothers production, Dark Castle. And it's a really fun sort of horror film where these two horror fans are trying to track down a lost 70s or 80s grindhouse film called The Hills Run Red. And they heard legendary stories about this horror movie, only a few people have seen it. It was so brutal they had to pull it from theaters. Does it exist? They go on a road trip to find this lost film, and they're looking for this legendary baby face killer. And along their journey, they meet a bunch of really interesting characters in this hick town, and it becomes a slasher. But it's a very smart film, and it's very well done, and amazing gore effects, special effects, like I said, if you're a film fan or film nerd, you'll love it, because there's so many references to grindhouse films as well. And I just think it's one that not many people really talk about or have seen. I do know it finally got a Blu-ray release. I think about a year ago, but it just got dumped direct to DVD here through Warner Brothers. But yeah, it's a great little fun film. I don't know, you know, many people have seen it, but I think it's one of the, like I said, sort of the end of the era, end of the road. It was actually perfectly timed because 2009, it felt like it was when the direct-to-video for horror kind of went out, you know. I mean, this is probably one of the last ones shot on 35mm as well in terms of video. So, but it's fun. Like I said, it's a really fun, creepy, gory, just action-packed sort of interesting flash film, which not many...
Sorry, I was just... interrupting you. I'm like, oh, you know, I've heard of it, but I actually haven't seen it. So there's one on the list I haven't seen.
I
can't add. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I will watch it now.
No, just saying it's relatively unseen. Like I said, for years I was recommending it to people. I was like, you got to see Hills Run Red, and I because it did get, like I said, did get a local DVD here, but that was about it. And not many people I know have seen, or if they have seen it, it's quite a low chance, but yes, sorry, go ahead.
I've seen it. It's been quite a while. Probably haven't seen it since it came out on DVD, but I did quite enjoy it for most part. I mean, I wasn't totally blown away by it or anything, but I still thought it was a fun little slasher nonetheless. But I think what also drew me to it, because one of the villains in the film is played by Sophie Monk.
Sophie Monk, yep.
Yes. And I thought she was actually surprisingly good.
Very good.
As the villain, she's like one of the main villains of the film, and she was quite good, and I was really pleasantly surprised. I was like, damn, she could actually be legit scary.
I think what I remember is distinctly like the cover having some weird like mask child doll thing.
Yeah, the baby face killer.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Ugh. I've added it to my Letterboxd watch list, so I'll get back to you on that one.
The Sophie Monk, she plays a convincing redneck, which kind of you wouldn't suspect, but it's And I think a lot of confusion was also people like Hills Have Eyes. Like a lot of my friends got it mixed up. Like, you mean Hills Have Eyes? I'm like, no, Hills Run Red. But yes,
yeah, because the Hills Have Eyes remake came out a couple of years before or something. Yeah, again, like that could be on this list, but I think it's a little bit more well known. But again, that's an example of a fucking awesome remake.
Yeah, that's how you do it.
Yeah. But Tony, have you seen John's pick?
Unfortunately, no, I haven't. But I've heard nothing but praise about it. And then, yes, I'm with you, Marcy, on that one. I put it on my Letterboxd list as well. I have to say, I believe it recently got a Blu-ray release from Shout.
Yeah, through Screen Factory. Yep, finally.
I got to check it out because I got to admit, that premise does sound intriguing. I really have to check it out.
I want to see it for the what's her fucking name? Sophie Monk factor now. Sorry, I cut you off again. Fuck me, Dale. Shut up.
I've seen it to believe it.
I'm sure you've
I just say, but if you're a film fan, it's, like I said, it just, it captures that. Like they, you tell the people who made this film are fans of old 70s and 80s horror. So there is a lot of throwback to it as well. But once again, I just think it was the end of a good swan song to the decade as we moved into the 2010 horrors, but we won't speak of those because...
Maybe for another podcast. Bede, I think it's your turn.
All right, for my second pick, I am going to go with a film that has an interesting kind of history behind it. I guess for a lot of people, they would consider this the Snyder Cut of the 2000s. And that, of course, is... the 2004 film, Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist,
and you know what, Bede? This was literally this was almost on my list as well. I'm actually glad you picked it so we can talk about it. Shut up, Marcy. Yes. Stop interrupting.
Yeah, indeed. Shut up, Marcy. but for all those out there who have never heard of Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist, what basically is? Back in 2004. Morgan Creek decided to make a fourth Exorcist film, but it was going to be a prequel. So they hired Paul Schrader to direct. Of course, Paul Schrader, for all those out there, is the director behind films such as American Gigolo, First Reformed, and most recently The Card Counter, and also the remake of Cat People. So he has a bit of horror pedigree behind him. So they hired him to direct this film. And he cast, like, Stellan Skarsgård and a whole bunch of other actors. But Stellan Skarsgård was going to be playing Father Merritt, who, of course, was played by Max von Sydow in the original Exorcist film. So this is going to be a prequel of, like, his first run-in with the demon Pazuzu.
Pazuzu,
indeed. And so Paul Schrader shot the film, did his cut, showed it to the producers, and the producers hated it.
Because they're a bunch of wanks. Sorry.
Indeed. And because they thought, oh, it's going to be a full-on scary film. Paul Schrader didn't deliver that. Like, it's a creepy film, but it's definitely a much more slower-paced, more existential type of film that examines evil. And so it's a much more weightier film in terms of how it approaches its themes. But the producers didn't like that, so they fired Paul Schrader and brought Rennie Harlan, the director behind Cliffhanger, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and a bunch of other movies.
Driven.
And Ford Failing.
Exactly.
And Cutthroat Island.
Yes. He's done so many movies.
Yeah.
To come in and reshoot most of the film, quite a lot of the film, and not only that, he recast a lot of the actors except for Stellan Skarsgård. So pretty much the film that ended up being was, of course, a much more fast-paced with tons of jump scares and, like, just it became a by-the-numbers typical horror film in the end. So basically, even though the film did well when it came out, but it completely just fallen flat with critics, and then it just dropped out of the box office not long after that. So, and people heard that, you know, there's this other cut of the film that existed. And so the studio went back to Paul Schrader and said, would you like to release your original cut of this film to, you know, on DVD? So he did. And having seen the film, if you watch both Exorcist the Beginning and Dominion back to back, they're even though they are exactly the same film, they are pretty much apples and oranges in how they approach their story. Like I said, this is definitely a much more slower paced film, but it definitely tries to go for more of the vibe of the original Exorcist, being more about the characters and sort of about these big weighty themes about faith and guilt and evil. And also, it's not a film that wants, like, it does have a lot of creepy moments in it, but it's more focused on as being an examination on pure evil, particularly of spiritual evil. And I think, like, it's not a perfect film by any means. Like, some of the CGI, which obviously probably was, like, early cut CGI that they didn't bother fixing up to release it.
Yeah.
But it's a much more interesting film and a much more engaging film. And, like, I guess the only sort of big positive of both is that Stellan Skarsgård is both great here and also in the beginning as well. So, but it's definitely a much more interesting film. Like, it's not perfect by any means, but if you have Paul Schrader at the helm of it, you're definitely going to have something that's a lot more interesting and more weighty in terms of how it approaches the themes of its story.
Yeah.
And you're not going to have, like, a typical horror film either. You're just going to have something that's, I guess, kind of, I guess, quote-unquote, more adult.
I agree with pretty much everything you've said on this one. And again, it was a 31 Days of Horror film, I think the same year that I had picked Pulse on that list as well. I might have had a discussion with you about, oh, should I watch this? I can't, or something like that. But I was actually pleasantly surprised. I thought this is a really solid film. And I do like the themes. There's so much, like, crisis of faith and renewal of faith, which are very heavy themes within The Exorcist as a film and as a novel as well. And I just, it's very well done. It flows at a good pace. The performances are pretty solid. Yeah, some of the CGI is a bit crap, but it's actually a really solid kind of prequel, you know, altogether. And yeah, I was actually quite surprised that I enjoyed it as much as I did when I watched it. But yeah, it's completely different from whatever Rennie Harlan had to hack together. But yeah.
And what about you? What about you, Tony?
I have seen Dominion and I loved it. I actually did a back-to-back of the beginning and Dominion when the Blu-ray came out, and oh boy. Two completely different films, and Paul Schrader's was more psychological than anything.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it. like a lot of people may know, but The Exorcist is my all-time favorite horror film. And I saw that for the first time when I was 11. And I just fell in love with it. And watching the others, but watching the sequels, I was happy with Paul Schrader's version, but Rennie Harlan's, oh boy. Mm. It was a mess. You could tell it was just tooled around with my producers, and it was all cut up and all that. But yeah, but Paul Schrader's version, I got to say, the last 20 minutes of the film I thought was pretty good. I thought it was quite impressive. And yes, I do prefer Schrader's version over Harlan's any day. And it was great.
And what about you, John?
Yeah, same thing. I saw Exorcist the Beginning in the cinema, actually. And
poor thing.
Yeah. Not good. Very disappointed by it, particularly, you know, being a big fan of Exorcist 1 and 3.
And 3, yeah.
Yeah, we'll ignore 2. But yeah, and I did see Dominion. I liked it a lot, and I actually... it's good. It's very good. I like Schrader's films, but you're right. It's more of a psychological...
Yeah.
And more creepy, like more of a slow burn. Unlike the Rennie Harlan, he's just an action director. It's just, you know, like I said, just bagoo.
Yeah, and it kind of really fits in that sort of the way that you've got The Exorcist and the way you have Exorcist 3, which is, again, very psychological. A lot of the similar themes, but it takes on this more psychological approach, and it's not all about the jump scares or the gore or anything like that. So as if you watch, like, The Exorcist 3 and... Dominion, it's you know, that's what you need with The Exorcist, and that for me it works
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely,
I didn't think that. That's actually it's the perfect trilogy, if you want to say Exorcist. Yeah, just ignore the crap in between.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you want to, if any of you listening want to do this trilogy, I suggest the theatrical cut of Exorcist 3, not the don't get me wrong, the Legion director's cut of Exorcist 3 was pretty good, but
I agree.
Full of Exorcist 3, hands down, one of the best sequels ever. I loved it.
I love Exorcist 3.
Director's cut is just padding. Like, it's just a lot of dialogue scenes and nothing. Yeah. The theatrical cut's more tight, and I must smell like the ending of the theatrical.
Good choice, Bede. Love it.
Thank you. And now, Marcy, what is your third and final pick?
My final
pick. If you have any honorable mentions, feel free to shout at you.
A lot of the things I thought about, like, you guys have picked as well. So they would have been honorable mentions. I'm trying to think of what year was, like, Lake Mungo.
That would have been 2008.
There you go. Honorable mention, Lake Mungo, in case no one mentions it. Beautiful movie. But I've picked three movies that weren't American, so I had the Australian, had Japanese, and I'm going to go with Canada. Who calls it Canada? It's Canada. I was kidding. And again, another 31 Days of Horror discovery, one that I'd been wanting to watch for so long, just never got around to it, and that's Pontypool. And fuck me dead, this movie is fucking amazing. I loved it. And again... it feels so sort of like relevant today, because it's like, you know, it's set in this, basically this one set with they're on the radio, they're hearing reports of things happening and they're trying to report what's going on. They have no idea. And it's like, this sounds like today where no one knows what the fuck's going on. Is this real news? Is that real news? I don't know. But it's the weirdest, unique, you know, sort of zombie film that focuses on, like, audio and visual... audio, so when you're listening and talking, it incorporates these things that you don't think about with, you know, a pandemic of zombies or the undead or a disease or something. And it's just... It's paced so bloody well. It's so intriguing. And you're with these, like... main character, really, just with the one sort of dickhead disc jockey, and he's so fucking good and it's so engaging. I fucking loved this when I saw it, and I'm like, man, no one talks enough about Pontypool and just how bloody amazing it is. Oh my god, I really want to, like, rewatch it again. And it's something I would be comfortable in showing Mr. Super Marcy, because he's not the biggest on horror, but it's one that it doesn't rely on the gore or anything like that. It's telling this story, and you have to be with what is potentially something so unreliable because you don't know if there's something really going on, if wires have been crossed, what the hell. But my God, what a great movie. And I love discovering just like little hidden gems like this. And if you haven't seen Pontypool, fucking just go watch Pontypool. And that's my quick review because fucking, what else can I say except fucking awesome? Bloody hell.
Fucking hell. What about you, Tony? Have you seen Pontypool?
Well, I better go and fucking watch Pontypool.
You're going to watch Pontypool, mate. Get to it.
I haven't seen it. I've got to get into it.
From what you're
just explaining, Marcy, it sounds good. I got to give it a go.
I think you actually really appreciate it because I think, you know, we between the four of us, like, yeah, we do have some differing tastes, but I think we do also have a lot of things in common. Even if we may not like something, we have an appreciation for it. And yeah. I just can't recommend this enough. It's so good. I had to look him up. Stephen McCaddy as the DJ. He's just, I loved him in it. He's so charismatic. And you're just with him. Like, you don't really like him that much at first, but then you start to, and it's like, what the fuck's going on? This is great. Oh, my God. Just, mwah. Chef's kiss. Mwah. Bellissimo. Tony,
what about you, John?
Tony, report back when you watch it, by the way.
Will do.
No, I haven't seen it, so I'm going to put that on my
way. Report now. Back, yes.
I heard of it through a few when it came out. Like it was around a few like horror sites and stuff when it came out. But I never got around seeing it, so I'm...
Tony, John, watch this movie. Report back to me, please. It's...
Will do.
Mwah.
I don't know. Did it get a release here locally, or I just... Because I feel like it's one...
Might have had a DVD-ish release.
I think it did, sure.
Yeah. Because I must have just completely missed it. But yeah, I'm going to track that down.
I'm so glad that I put it on my 31 Days of Horror. And that's a good excuse for doing 31 Days of Horror with things you haven't seen. It's like catch up for things you haven't seen, but also, you know, just discovery and blah, blah, blah. But, mwah, Bede, I know you're a big fan of this too, yeah?
Really enjoyed this film a lot as well. And I think it's interesting because around that time when this film came out, I was starting to take notice of Stephen McCaddy as an actor because I think I first noticed him in 300. And then, of course, he popped up in Watchmen as well.
Mm.
And then I saw him in Pontypool where it was like, again, he's a character actor who rarely gets lead roles, but it's really cool to kind of get to see him shine in a lead role.
As like a lead, yeah. Like,
and he's really great in this film. And I remember like back in the day on the Joe Blow forums, Marcy, when you and I used to frequent, used to do this thing every year was like this annual horror movie awards where I kind of like the Oscars I would put up on the in a thread. I like have all the nominees there and people can like vote for who they think was the best. And I remember one year I had Stephen McCaddy as a nominee for best actor, a lot of heavy hitters. And Stephen McCaddy was one of the most voted performances in that category. And he ended up winning the quote unquote award for that year. So a lot of people who had seen the film really love his performance and he's just fantastic in it. And it's also, like you say, it's a very unique film because it's set mostly in a radio station. And it's a different take on the zombie genre as well.
I don't want to give too much away, seeing as John and Tony haven't seen it yet, but yeah, fucking get on it. But yeah, it's such a unique take. And I think it was actually like the Arrow in the Head website and forums was where I first heard about it, like back when it came out, I think it was 2008, and just took me fucking 10 years to see it.
Deep.
And Tony, your last pick.
Well, first I'll do an honorable mention. The Orphanage, the Spanish film from 2007 or 2008. But
one I saw recently too. It's amazing.
That was a good one. Bloody and of course, cool. Another film. I know a lot of people have heard of this one, but it failed miserably at the box office, and I just thought it deserves some kind of honorable mention. 2007's Grindhouse.
Yes.
Or Grindhouse.
Same.
Fuck but yeah.
My final pick for this is a controversial one. Okay. 2009's Lars von Trier's Antichrist.
Oh.
That is my final
pick. You know what? Go with it.
I gotta say. Oh, boy.
Do you want to see genital decapitation and mutilation? This is for you.
Yes. That, bloody yes, hell. That's And I gotta say, I saw that first day, first session, wow. Dendy Cinemas in Newtown. And my God, I was the only person in the cinema and I was blown away. Even though the whole film is two characters, it's fucking nuts. Especially with the last half of the film, Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg, brilliant performances by the way.
Yep.
Some of the violence in this film is basically, well, you both just described genital mutilation and also something with a 2x4 piece of wood, and it's not pleasant to look at, especially for males. But yeah, and the one thing that was intriguing was it was a film about depression and basically about grief, you know, the loss of their child, and it's basically about grief grabbing you in different ways. Like one person is like, yeah, life goes on, and the other person just takes it to another level. And if you have the stomach for it, and believe me, there are some very violent sequences in that film, do yourself a favor and watch it. It is phenomenal. It's definitely one of my favorite films of the 2000s.
Yeah, that's a crazy pick. And it's you know, we have talked about like how some of these films having like that theme of like grief and depression, and that's something that Von Trier has in just about everything. It really captures that in these very different ways. I think I've seen Antichrist once and I haven't gone back to it, and it's just, I think it's so polarizing. Like there are so many just Jesus Christ fucking whoa. But Von Trier, like there's so many things that I think like wow. But again, this one is just, it's a whole nother level of, do I really want to watch this again? But I appreciate that, you know, you can say, yeah, fucking just watch this movie, because I guess if you're a cinephile, watch it at least once and change your life.
It'll change your life for the better or for the worse.
Yeah.
But it definitely isn't for everybody, but it is a good one. John, I know you've seen it. What did you think?
Yes, I love Antichrist. I really like Lars von Trier. And yeah, you're right, it's a very haunting film about grief, and that opening still haunts me.
The opening
just makes me sad every time I see it. But it's funny, I do have a story about this film. I've told it a few times.
Did you take a date there? Who took a first date to Antichrist?
That was me.
It was you, right? I knew it was one of you guys.
So at Dendy, I this girl I'd been seeing for a couple of weeks, and I said, oh, look.
Oh, God.
Lars von Trier film was playing. I don't know what I was thinking, because I said, watch Breaking the Waves and let me know what you think. And she watched, I think it's a great. So I thought, okay, if you can stomach Breaking the Waves, then surely this can't be that bad. And yeah, she just was so angry and just got up, didn't say anything, just walked off. And then I didn't hear from her again. So anyway,
I'm not surprised, John.
So anyway, that's a hilarious story. It's not the first time it's happened. It's a few times it's actually happened. I've taken dates to shocking movies. I really like Antichrist. And I just think visually just beautiful. And just everything about it. And yeah, like I said, it's hate or love it type film. But I'm the love camp for it. So.
Bead.
I must be a sadist because I've seen this film twice.
You're a sadist, yeah. That's why we call you terrible.
Oh, well, to be fair, I think Lars von Trier is a great filmmaker, but he's one of those filmmakers where a lot of his filmography I've only ever seen like once and don't need to see again, regardless whether I like the movie or not. I'm like, I like your movie, Lars, but I don't ever want to see this ever again. But to Antichrist was probably the only film of his that I've seen twice, mainly because I was so perplexed by it the first time, I wasn't sure what to think of it, and I needed a second watch to kind of, you know, sum up my feelings on it. And overall, I think it is a really good film. It is visually beautiful. It's definitely one of his most visually stunning films, and the performances are great from Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg, and the opening is very haunting, and The violence is very full on. I think that around there were moments where, like, you know, I don't need to see bloody jizz. I'm just going to fast forward this bit for just a few seconds. And not just definitely not print. And also, you know, Lars von Trier does not shy from showing any of this at all. And you know, it's one of those films where there's a lot of moments from this film, from it, that you can still remember, like, years later. Like, there are moments that I think back on that are like, I'll never get that image out of my head, ever.
I'll never think of Rusty the same way again.
Oh, jeez, yes.
But, yeah, I'm with you, but I actually saw that three times at the movies. The last time I saw it was at a special festival. John knows the story. I don't know about you two. Filmmaker John Waters came to Sydney, and he was doing double features. And his first night of double features was called Shock. And the double feature of that night was Irreversible and Antichrist.
Oh, jeez.
So that was something.
And do you want to hate life? There's your double feature.
Next time that double feature happens, I'm totally taking a first date there.
Oh, goodness. But yeah, but with Lars von Trier, he never hides away from violence, especially, no. I don't know if you've seen, I know it hasn't been officially been released here in Australia, the 5.5-hour director's cut of Nymphomaniac, that has probably one of the most extreme bits of violence. Well, not violence, another bit of self-mutilation to say it, but it's just very...
I haven't seen that film, actually. It's one of his, one of the few of his I haven't seen.
Yeah.
Might have to just watch that.
See, there's a
massive cut, yeah.
Watch the 5.5-hour version. Believe me, it's long, but it's worth it.
That's what she said. I had to fit one in there, come on.
Of course.
Exactly.
But, yeah, what a pick, though. Bloody Antichrist. And John taking first dates to Lars von Trier movies, like, what the fuck?
Not here at the time, but, yeah.
I mean, look.
We didn't know better.
I mean, look, if a first date was like, hey, you want to go see this fucked up movie with me? I'm like, fuck yeah, let's go.
The last time that happened, I think it was Tony. I took a date to see Colour Out of Space, and she was just horrified.
Oh, really? That's not even that bad.
She was really angry. I'm like, what's the hell's wrong with you? It's like, anyway.
I'm so angry. This wasn't the sexy Nicolas Cage movie I wanted.
Yeah, I know.
my partner was close to going to watch Colour Out of Space with us, but she read the synopsis and she changed her mind. But I would never show my partner Antichrist. No way. No. If I do, we're over. I can guarantee that.
Yeah. There's certain things you don't cross. That's one of them.
Exactly. John, what is your third and final pick? And if you have any honorable mentions, feel free to show. Let us know.
Yeah, I did. There were a few. Sorry, I've kind of forgotten already. Well, I was going to mention, because you're talking about Japanese film, Gozu was the other one I was going to talk about.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. I really want to see that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great...
I could actually add Japanese that to my letterbox.
Yeah, I mean, Al said, it's a really fun, strange, surreal Miike film, which, I think is really, really good. But look, I mean, like I said, all my picks, I'm not sure. I know going for art house and masterpieces, but mine have just been like direct. A lot of these are just like video store discoveries,
which that's I all love.
Yeah, all my picks are just, they're not masterpieces, but they're cheesy and they're fun. And so my next pick kind of sums up my picks. It is a 2001 film called The Shaft, also known as Down. Now, this is the Citizen Kane of killer elevator movies. Now.
Oh, I was thinking if it's called The Shaft. It's not a penis movie, it's an elevator type movie.
Yes.
If it was Lars von Trier, he would shut the penis in the elevator door, but that's beside the point. I think I've broken Tony.
Oh boy.
I apologize. John, please talk.
No.
So a bit of backstory of this, I discovered, I saw this, it was like a direct video DVD title when early 2000s, and I said, what's this movie called, The Shaft? And now, basically, the story behind it, Dick Maas, a Dutch director, made a film called Die Lift in 1983, and it was a big hit in Europe. Oh. And for years, he'd been trying to remake it, and they finally got funding to make an American huge, like, this was a big budget. Like, we're talking, like, $10, $15 million film. And it's about a killer elevator. I'm not making this up.
No, I just looked it up now. The cast this movie has, oh my God.
The cast, I know, right? And no one's heard of it or seen it. So essentially, there's this big building in New York, and they've got a brand new elevator put in. But something weird's happening. Like, it's got a mind of its own. It's going up and down, playing tricks on people, killing people. Like a blind guy, like, it went down, so he falls off, and these pregnant women get stuck on there, and one of them delivers a baby, and something's going on with this elevator. And so Naomi Watts, who shows up. Now, this is just before Mulholland Drive. I think this was, or maybe the same year she did this film. Mm. And she's a journalist trying to see what the hell is going on with this place and doing a bit of investigation. Is it a faulty lift? And a lift repairman, played by James Marshall, if you're a Twin Peaks fan, know him. He actually is the guy trying to, he's the one trying to figure out what's going on. So he gets involved. And then it leads into the lift starts killing random people, and then it involves government conspiracy. Is it terrorists? What is going on with this lift? And Ron Perlman's in there as like a sort of secret agent, and you've got Michael Ironside and this insane cast, and the budget's huge. It's a beautifully shot, epic 35mm movie, and it's so much fun. It has a great sense of humor, lots of great kills and gore, and the last 10 minutes is full on action, where I don't want to spoil it, but it is like the lift takes on a mind of its own, and it becomes a full on. It's unbelievable. Well, like I said, it's got dumped to DVD. It got dumped to DVD around the world, actually. Never got a theatrical release. And yeah, I just think it's a really underrated 2000s horror, which no one's seen or heard of. But I'll leave it at that. That is Down. It's got two names, Down or The Shaft. We got it over here as The Shaft, but I think Down was the US.
Yeah, title. If on Letterboxd it shows up as Down. So I've added that to my. I'm like, I'm very intrigued by this movie.
It is something. Yeah, there's a full SWAT team that go in at the end. Oh, it's just like, the fuck is this movie?
What was that other weird lift movie? I don't know if it was 2000s or early 2010s.
Devil.
Yeah.
Devil.
So yeah, there is a market for evil elevators or something.
Evil elevators, yeah. But this is like the Citizen Kane of evil elevator movies.
Amazing.
But yes, I don't, like I said, once again, it's one that's pretty damn obscure. I don't know if anyone's...
Mm. Has anyone actually seen this? Beat? Tony?
It's funny. I think I remember seeing the VHS cover of this when I was in the US back in 2002.
Yeah.
Like, I just saw it as, I believe it was The Shaft when I saw it at the video shop. And of course, like you say, John, this was just around, when Mulholland Drive was about to come out, or The Ring. So definitely this film was definitely put out there to kind of capitalize on Naomi Watts' sudden fame. Like, she made this film before those. I actually owned The Lift because I had the Blu-ray of it.
Oh.
because I believe in the US, Blue Underground released both The Lift and Down on Blu-ray.
So you'll have to bring it over so we can watch it.
Yes. We'll watch the German version, then we'll watch the one with Naomi Watts.
We'll watch Dach Lift or whatever it was called.
They're both great. They're both great movies, both of them. And I just think it just does my head in, like, how did this get like a massive budget US remake? Mm. How this got greenlit just amazes me. But,
I'm down with these weird, obscure picks. I love it.
Yes.
So this did get a local DVD, very rare. I can't remember who put out, but it was one that I did see. Yeah. Maybe tape. I can't remember. Anyway, long time ago.
And now.
Alrighty. Indeed. I've got one final pick, but I've also got two honorable mentions. One of which, of course, is the 2005 Japanese found footage film Noro the Curse.
Another one I really want to see, which I should add to my list. Thank you.
And I heard about this movie for quite a while, and I know that it was like on the US Shudder. So I was like, oh, yeah, I'll finally check this one out. And I heard a lot of people did say, like, oh, this is up there as one of the creepiest found footage horror films. And I was like, yeah, I hear that with a lot. There's some, but, you know, I'll be the judge of that. And I watched it, and it legit creeped me the hell out. I won't say too much about it, but definitely go into this film with no knowledge of the plot, because I think that does add so much to it. Another one I definitely loved was the 2008 horror comedy Fido.
Yes, I fucking loved that when it came out. I love that
piece. Which was like, as a horror comedy that's set in an alternative 1950s where there was a zombie outbreak, but it has been controlled, and all the surviving zombies have now become house pets for suburban families. And, like, this one kid whose parents are played by Carrie Ann Moss and Dylan Baker, they decide to adopt a zombie who's played by Billy Connolly, and they name him Fido. And it's basically like a Lassie kind of Rin Tin type of story, but the pet is a zombie.
It's such a unique and fun film. I love that you've had that as your honorable mention, because again, I thought about picking that too for my list.
And I haven't really heard a lot of people talked about this since it first came out, so I think it's one that I think people need to rediscover.
Yeah.
But for my final pick, it's a film that I know, Marcy, you've seen this movie, and I know for a fact you love this movie, but I think only a few other people have seen this movie other than us. And this was one that I think it was just, I was down at the video shop. I randomly saw it up on the shelf. I thought, oh, this looks interesting.
Mm.
And I read it, and it just blew me away. And that, of course, was the 2009 British horror film Heartless. I
love it so much. It's one of my favorites.
Which stars Jim Sturgess. And was written and directed by Philip Ridley, who previously did The Passion of Darkly Noon and The Reflecting Skin. It was his long-awaited third feature. And for those out there who have never heard of Heartless, so basically what this film is about, it tells the story of this very lonely, isolated guy who was born with a heart-shaped birthmark on the left side of his face. And he's like considers himself like ugly by society, so he basically just hangs out at home with his mum and kind of just, you know, it keeps himself distant from society. But then something happens where a family member of his is attacked and killed by demons. So he decides to go out on a revenge and find all these demons and kill them. But the thing is, though, that's only the first act of the story. It decides to take a sudden shift in the second half and completely takes it in a different direction that is both unexpected but very rewarding. Because what I think is so great about this film is, even though it is a horror film, it's also quite an effective drama that by the end of it, you cannot help but start bawling by the end of it, because it's also a very sad film as well, and a very emotionally charged one. And it's just got a brilliant performance by Jim Sturgess, who's just phenomenal in it. And I know a lot of people say, oh, Jim Sturgess, he's not that great of an actor. But I'm like, have you seen Heartless? Go see Heartless and report back to me, because he is amazing in this film. And it's a film that, you know, if you've seen Philip Ridley's other work, like, he's a guy who, like, does very interesting things and kind of subverts genre expectations and is... and has a lot of things to say with his films as well. And it's a film that, by the end of it, you're kind of sort of thinking back and forth on like some of the things that you've seen within the story. And yeah, this is a film that I know that not that many people have talked about. And every time I bring it up, literally everyone's like, I've never heard of this film. And then the few people I've recommended it to who have seen it have come back being really pleasantly surprised by it.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of those people, of course, is you, Marcy.
Yeah, once you told me about it and I watched it, I was obsessed with Heartless. I know, like, some of our earlier podcasts, we did discuss Heartless, and I fucking love Heartless. It's truly, truly phenomenal film. Like, wow. It's for me, it's like a 5-star film. I can't, like, fault it It's not it's going to be everyone's cup of tea. It's not perfect, but it's one of those films that just hit me so hard. And it's really interesting. A lot of our films have like such similar themes in weird ways, and they're so different. Like, what the hell? Are we that depressed because we've been in a bloody pandemic for 2 years? Let's watch depressing shit. Bloody hell.
Indeed. And it's kind of got like a big supporting cast as well, because you got Joseph Mole, who was in Game of Thrones, was in this film. Noel Clark, Clemens Posey from the Harry Potter films is in this one, and also Timothy Spall is in it as well.
Wow, I love it.
Oh, and Eddie Marsden's in it as well for a very memorable cameo in the film too. And it's just really great. And again, it sort of shifts gears with its story because you're never quite sure where it's going to go. Like, you think, oh, it's going to be like a Death Wish type film, but with a guy with a heart-shaped birthmark on his face going around killing demons. But then it goes in a completely different direction in the last half that sends it down sort of this, just sort of this very haunting and emotionally charged finale.
Yeah, I need to rewatch this. It's just amazing. And I love the song that goes with the film too.
Oh yeah, the score is amazing. It's done by the same composer who did The Descent. So it's the same score as that. It also, I believe he also did Memento as well, from what I remember. And also it has a kick-ass soundtrack, which Philip Ridley wrote most of the songs, and also Jim Sturgess sings quite a number of the songs on the soundtrack.
Amazing. Have you guys heard of it? Have you guys seen it?
I haven't, and from hearing both of your reactions to it, I must.
Add it to that Letterboxd wish watch list.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Have you seen Reflecting Skin, or what was the other one?
The Passion of Darkling.
That's right. Have you seen those?
I've seen The Passion of Darkling Moon. That one I really enjoyed.
And Reflecting Skin, again, Bede, you told me to put it on one of my lists.
Great.
Fucking hell, that's a movie, all right. And yeah, like, wow, why isn't this guy making movies like every 2 years? Like, what the fuck, dude? Stop writing plays and shit. Make movies. I need them. John, have you seen or heard of Heartless?
No, I've heard of it. I know of it. But I'd seen his other two films, but I never saw Heartless. Once again, it was just one that I just never got around to. Because I knew, because I was amazed by both his films. Like I said, Passion, which has, you know, an amazing performance by our favorite, which is a very underrated film as well, and yeah, Reflecting Skin is a great take on the vampire tale.
Amazing.
Yeah, but never seen it, no, so I'm gonna put it on my list. Yeah, I think once again, because I thought it's a newer film and it may not be as good as his previous works, but I'm gonna
fucking amazing. Again, yeah, talking about Heartless again, amazing choice, Bede. People, just add it to your like Letterboxd watch list, please.
Yeah, I'm just like looking up Philip Ridley's like Wikipedia page, and you're right, Marcy, you're not exaggerating. A lot of the stuff he's been doing since this movie has been like stage plays. But he's got his hands in everything. It's like he's like a one-man army. He's doing like musicals and writing songs and exhibitions and like writing monologues. And
living his best life, but fucking make more movies, dude.
and even writing novels too. Like, this dude is multi-talented, but yet he's only ever made 3 movies.
Yeah, make more movies, dude. Come on.
He wrote The Craze as well for
the British
gangsters
for with Peter Madig, with Gary Kemp and his brother in the lead roles.
Wow. Yeah, so what's the extras on the Arrow disc of the Passion of Darkling Noon, and they did say that it was a bomb. Like, it didn't do very well. I think they kind of killed his film career at that point, which is sad because he was on a bit of a roll. Reflecting Skin, Passion, and then he's just a real unsung. He should have kept making we should have way more than 3 for this guy.
Amazing stuff.
Agreed. Yeah. Absolutely agreed.
And that actually wraps up our show. We did it. We made it.
And we talked about some really awesome undiscovered gems that I think for all of our listeners who are listening to right now should definitely check out, because like I said, like the 2000s were a very underrated year overall for horror, even though a lot of great stuff did come out and a lot of classics as well. But I think there are some great gems that, you know, that would easily have gone past a lot of people that based on our recommendations, I think everyone should check these films out.
Yeah, and I've got more on my watch list that I'm now keeping on Letterboxd. So, yeah, absolutely excited to watch these things that I haven't seen.
But I guess that could be a wrap for this episode of the Super Podcast. Thank you for both Tony and John for coming on the show and sharing your undiscovered horror gems from the 2000s.
Thank you both. It was an absolute blast being on here. It was great chatting to you. Hope to join again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely love chatting to you guys and, yeah, love enjoying podcasting with you guys too. So definitely you're both are going to be on After Dark with Super Marcy this year, so excited for that. I'm going to talk about lots of controversial shit, so it should be great. everyone can find us here at the Super Network at supermarcy.com. And if you want to find all our podcasts or all the stuff with the Super Network, your easiest shot is to go to linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. All of our links are there. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We're everywhere. Give us a like. Give us feedback on your own, undiscovered or hidden gem of the horror 2000s. And if you want to follow me, you can check me out on Twitter at supermarcy.com and on Letterboxd at super_Marcy. And Beat, where can people find you?
If people want to find me personally, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeatJabine, or my personal writer's page at Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And of course, you can find me at Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/BeatJabine. And of course, you can find all my writings over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns.
Indeed, you can. Guys, where can people check you out with your podcast, The Indicator Cast?
John, that's your beauty.
Oh, yes. Yes, you can find it on any good podcast streaming networks, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Just look for Indicator Cast. We do also have a Facebook page. You can reach us there as well. And I am active as well on Facebook and also on Letterboxd, just as my name, John Matthews with one T. That's where you can find me.
Yeah, and you can also find John and myself at the Imprint Fan Appreciation Facebook group. And also I'm on Letterboxd under FilmNut79. Yes, and also on Facebook as well. So if you ever want to chat with any of us to talk about film and all that, happy to do so.
And recommend the Imprint group, because Imprint, at least for here, we get a lot of really cool titles, and if you love your physical media, it's great stuff. And yeah, I'm loving being in the group, seeing everyone's picks and reviews of films, and definitely gets me curious to see stuff I haven't even heard of. So yeah, good job on the group, love it, awesome shit.
Thank you.
Yeah, and links always in our show notes. So. Thank you guys so much. It's always a pleasure. You guys have become some of our, most awesomest friends. Love it. And until next time, go watch fucking horror movies, losers. Nah, that was mean. But still, go watch horror movies. Yeah. You're not losers if you watch them. Done.
Exactly. See you, everybody. Bye.
Thanks,
guys. Bye.
Bye.
Then the two of us need look no more. We both found what we were looking for. With a friend to call my own, I'll never be alone. And you, my friend, will see you've got a friend in me. Ben, you're always running here and there. You feel you're not wanted anywhere. If you ever look behind and don't like what you find, something you should know. You've got a place to go.
You've got a place to go.
I used to say, I and me. Now it's us. Now it's we. I used to say, I and me. Now it's us. Now it's we.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. And now back to the show.